Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Kaelin McPherson. Tonight, our own Mark Dunley talks with Richard Witt of the Rural and Migrant Ministries about farm workers and the fight for better overtime pay and how COVID has impacted farm workers.
Then HMM's Catherine Rafferty is joined by members of the Albany Birth Justice Storytelling Project, which is preparatory action research to collect quantitative data on the experience of Black birthing people from Albany who are impacted by racial inequities in birth outcomes.
We also hear from H. Bosch Jr. in his series to highlight shining stars of the community. Today, highlighting John Carter, Global Director of Travel Industry and Business Travel Sales for the Omni Hotels and Resorts.
And after that, we hear part two of our interview with Kim Brown about her quest for clemency.
And finally, we have an interview with David Banks about why we should defund the police and how it can be beneficial and more. But first, here are some headlines.
After protesters seized control of the federal Capitol for several hours, lawmakers in the early morning hours of Thursday completed their certification of the election of Joe Biden as president. Condemnation of President Trump's role in promoting the riot was widely condemned worldwide. Senator Schumer and Congressman Tonko were among numerous elected officials calling for the removal of either impeachment or to use the 25th Amendment.
After the vote was taken, Trump called for peaceful transfer of power. Investigations are underway as why to the Capitol police failed to protect Congress, with many noting that the protesters would have been treated far more harshly if they had been with Black Lives Matter movement rather than the white militia supporters. The Capitol Police Chief condemned that many officers acted bravely in the face of mass violence, criminal activities, though almost all were allowed to leave without arrest.
Meanwhile, the new session of the Pennsylvania Senate got off to a chaotic start Tuesday, with Republicans refusing to seat a Democratic senator whose election victory has been certified by state officials. Amid much clamor, Republicans also took the rare step of removing the Democratic Lieutenant Governor, John Fetterman, from presiding over the session.
The Times Union reports that Proud Boy member protest rally outside the Capitol, Albany, on Wednesday was stabbed multiple times and underwent emergency surgery. The suspect, described as a member of the Antifa on his social media, is accused of stabbing two people during the melee that erupted in East Capitol Park between a group that gathered to support President Trump and a smaller of counter-protesters who showed up. Several of them alleged armed with weapons. Police have closed off State Street along the Capitol.
COVID continues to rage in the Capital District and nationwide. Albany has been the hardest hit, with one more death bringing the total to 240. There were 283 new coronavirus cases overnight, with 20 more residents hospitalized for a new record of 163. 19 are in intensive care. And now, for those of you just tuning in, you are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, coming to you from the Sanctuary of Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary.
So for our first segment, in the Farm Workers Fair Practice Law finally passed last year, farm workers don't receive 1.5 wages for overtime until after 60 hours, Last week, the Cuomo administration voted to not take action to reduce the 60-hour threshold in a 2-to-1 vote, with the head of the Buffalo Union League casting the deciding vote. Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Magazine has the story.
We're talking with Richard Witt with Rural and Migrant Ministry, and we wanted to talk to Richard about a decision recently made by the Department of Labor not to shorten the length of time for overtime before farm workers get a little higher pay, but also about the issue of how farm workers have been impacted by the COVID crisis. But Richard, why don't you just give us a brief introduction as to what is Rural and Migrant Ministry?
Rural and Migrant Ministry is a statewide organization. We have 4 worker education centers in different parts of rural New York. We were born in 1981, so 2021 is our 40th anniversary, and we work with rural workers and their families, especially farm workers, through educational programs, youth programs, and accompaniment programs. And when we use the word accompaniment, that means standing with workers as they seek to improve their working and living conditions. Probably what we're most known for is shepherding the Farm Worker Fair Labor Practices Act in Albany for several decades, which was a bill that would have required farm workers to be treated equally to other workers in New York State. For decades upon decades, farm workers were excluded from such basic rights as a day of rest, disability insurance, protection when bargaining collectively. And finally, in 2019, the bill passed. The governor signed it. But there was one little catch there, which was instead of giving farm workers equality on overtime, in other words, that they would start receiving overtime pay after working 40 hours, the law put in place that they would receive overtime after working 60 hours in a week. They then went on to put in a provision creating a farm worker wage board that would be made up of 3 people and would gather in the following year to review whether there should be a pathway from 60 hours to 40 hour threshold.
Now the wage board met recently, and it included the head of the Farm Bureau, the head of the AFL-CIO, and the head of the I believe Buffalo Urban League, and they voted not to lower the threshold from 60 hours to 40 hours, but they felt they needed more time to study the issue and the impact upon farm workers, and I guess also the impact of the COVID crisis. What did you think of that decision and some of the, you know, rationale offered for that?
The difficulty for us is the comments of 2 of the wage board members, the comments offered up by the Farm Bureau, comments echoed in a recent newspaper editorial, talked about now's not the time to make this change. And they specifically talked about the COVID pandemic. The difficulty for us is that's what's always been said. Now's not the time. You know, the economy isn't right. We can't afford this. Prices are down. And what happens is it always is an issue of economics in the minds of these commenters and human rights. And, you know, other businesses, the whole world, without exaggeration, has been struggling through the pandemic, but they didn't take it out by and large on their workers. They didn't say that the workers had to subsidize their well-being. So I have difficulty with that. Now, I understand that perhaps this panel, well, perhaps one of the members of the panel, Ms. McDuffie from the Urban League in Buffalo, might be new to understanding the issues of the plight of farm workers. But I would have hoped that they would have created some sort of pathway. So, I mean, you can say, all right, we're going to study this, but we're going to make the commitment that we're going to lower the threshold from, say, 60 to 55 a year from now. You know, give people time to get settled into it, which is one of the pleas of the Farm Bureau. But they didn't do that. They just rejected the thing outright. And frankly, I'm astonished that a leader, Ms. McDuffie from the Urban League, whose organization has such a long history of standing for civil rights and whose symbol is an equality sign, would not find some pathway toward equality.
And of course, the exclusion of, you know, farm workers from particularly a lot of the federal organizing rights is directly a vestige of, you know, Jim Crow laws. And you would expect that the Urban League would, you know, sort of get that. And I also will note that at the same time, not that this board or another board had direct control of it, but there had been push, you know, there is a phase in, particularly upstate, to increase in the minimum wage for other workers. And, you know, the business community did fight to halt that, but that did not occur. But how have farm workers in general fared, you know, during this COVID crisis?
I think we owe a great deal of thanksgiving to our brothers and sisters who are laboring in the fields, on the dairy farms, in the orchards, in the food processing plants, who have worked so hard to feed all of us during this pandemic and whom we can easily take for granted. And it has been a very difficult time for them. They've been required to go to work. We just heard or worked actually with a gentleman the other day who was being forced to go to work, even though he had tested positive for the virus. His boss said, you know, he needed to be at work when it was pointed out that he did not need to be at work. That was not safe for him to be at work. There was a long battle, and finally the Department of Labor, the New York State Department of Labor, had to step in. And shortly thereafter, the man was taken to the hospital, where not only was he battling COVID, he now had pneumonia. So the workers are very vulnerable. They want to work, but they also want to be safe, which has then led to a huge mental stress on the workers and their families about wondering if they were going to get the virus. And then on top of all that, a good number of the workers were not eligible for stimulus funds. We're fearful about being evicted. We're struggling with trying to figure out how are they going to survive financially? How are they going to get food on their tables? It's been a really challenging year for brothers and sisters who are unseen and yet whom we are in relationship with on a daily basis as we eat the food they get to us.
So Richard, we're out of time. I know you'd wanted to get to that. You did have one little victory in the EPA is continuing the 100-foot rule, keeping away, you know, pesticide spraying from workers. If people want more information about Rural and Migrant Ministry, how can they do that?
www.ruralmigrantministry.org. That's all one word. you can look us up, and that will give you our contact info.
Thank you very much, Richard Witt, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Again, that was the website is www.ruralmigrantministries.org. That was Mike Dunley speaking with Rural Migrant Ministries.
HMM's Catherine Rafferty is joined by members of the Albany Birth Justice Storytelling Project, which combines photo, voice, narrative, and transformative storytelling to collect quantitative data on the experience of Black birthing people from Albany who are all impacted by racial inequities in birth outcomes.
Today, I'm joined by members of the Albany Birth Justice Storytelling Project based at the University of Albany. Thank you guys for speaking with me today about the project.
Hi, how are you?
I'm Nikia. I'm sorry.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you for inviting us, yes.
Could you each introduce yourselves and your role in the project?
Hi, so I'm Kia Tillman, and I am the co-chair of BirthNet, one of the co-chairs of BirthNet, and I helped, sat with these wonderful ladies and just kind of listened to their process and gave support wherever I could.
I am Destiny. I am currently UAlbany MSW student, and I am one of the moms that were interviewed for the project.
My name is Chloe. I am a SUNY Albany alumnus. I was the listener who got to listen to Destiny's story.
Great. And I'm Rajni Bhatia. I'm associate professor in women's gender and sexuality studies, and I was also one of the coordinators along with Nakia.
Could one of you describe what the project is?
I'll just briefly say that the project is a community-based participatory action research project in which we involved a team of co-researchers. They were members of the community of Albany, all storytellers from Albany County, as well as a team of mainly undergraduate students, but one graduate student and one alumna, who is Chloe. It started in the spring of 2019 when we interviewed students to be a part of the project and made selections. And then over the summer, we started doing some background reading. The students did an autobiographical photo voice narrative. So the story's methods are based on two innovative feminist approaches to research, which include transformative storytelling and also photo voice. Those were methods that we did a little bit of training in through the fall semester, and that was also when we started making connections to members of the community.
So could one of you tell me more about those research methods? What is photo voice and what is transformative storytelling?
The photo voice narrative is a narrative form where the storyteller is telling a story, and then you have like the pictures going on top of the audio as a way to help connect the story and the images together so that the audience can get a better picture of what was going on. I think that for our project, that was a really good narrative style because it allowed people to like see what was going on and like hear the story without being like talked at or like lectured. And transformative storytelling, I think, is one of the ways that the storyteller is able to have like autonomy over their own stories. I think a lot of times like stories of people are like lost in the way that it's being told. And so the transformative storytelling allows for the person whose story it is to have like full control over how the story is told and still allow the listeners or the readers to be immersed in the stories.
That's great. Great. And I would just add that like ours was an adaptation of photo voice. So there are many different ways in which photo voice is used. In some cases, community researchers like have like take cameras into the community and take photographs and then sort of collectively interpret those images in connection to like their experiences in their daily lives. In our case, a lot of the photographs were contributed by the storytellers themselves. So it were, you know, there were many times the sort of regular photographs people take around the time that their children are born. And I think there's an interesting contrast when you look at those narratives between these, you know, sort of these images that sort of tell the story of, oh yes, a very happy, like a child was born, and you know, there's happiness in that, of course, but there's always the traumatic parts of what one goes through in that process are kind of covered up. And that's kind of what you're hearing as you're listening to, as you're watching those images. And I think that contrast is really makes for a very strong experience.
How did the project get started, and what was the original goal of the project? Maybe Rajani or Nakia could answer that one.
Emily Cooper did an internship. She did her internship with BirthNet. That she had the creative initiative to try out a couple of these stories. And one of them was with Nakia. So I think Nakia can tell you a little bit about that.
Yeah, so Emily Cooper, she was amazing because her goal for the project was to center Black and Brown women due to the fact that, you know, we are, you know, we experience racism and traumatic incidences in hospitals and, you know, before birth, during birth, and even sometimes after birth. So she wanted to have me tell my story of, you know, my experience, and then just to kind of sit back and let me tell my story, not be the control of the story. She thought that was very important. So, and it was amazing. And what was revealing to her was that, you know, though I experienced, you know, racism when I was 17 to have my first one, I also experienced a level of racism at 37 having my baby. And, you know, so, you know, over that, you know, almost 20 years of evolution of, you know, of this world, the fact that we're still dealing with it, and our stories of, you know, Black women saying, you know, listen, we're still going through this. It hasn't changed. It's not, you know, and until we all as women, you know, get involved and lift each other up, it's not gonna change. And so she allowed me to tell my story, both stories actually, and just kind of make it and show also that, you know, these aren't isolated incidences. You know, if you can say, you know, pick one or two things, you know, you can kind of brush it off. But she was also trying to explain that these stories are happening to women who don't even know each other. They're not even in the same state. So these are continuous stories that are continuing to happen. And we need to get these stories out, you know, to let the world know that, listen, this is still going on. You know, women, Black and Brown women during childbirth, you know, they're struggling. And how do we start to deal with this situation, because it's not going anywhere. And so it's even like uplifting for me, because, you know, when you're going through something, you deal with it and then you move on. But when you tell your story, you're like, oh my God, that, yeah, that did happen. So, you know, and it kind of gets you going, because, you know, even with my work through BirthNet, which is, I thought was cool, because their whole goal and mission is to get into the hospital, the system, to kind of attack the structure of racism when dealing with Black and Brown women in these places. So telling my story kind of fit right in with the mission of what they're doing to, again, center Black and Brown women, tell their stories and get into these hospitals, which, you know, it's one of the places where I think people don't realize is where structural racism happens a lot. It happens, and, you know, you think you go into the hospital as a place of care, and a lot of times we go in there with people thinking that, you know, as long as we're getting some kind of care, we should just shut up and kind of like be appreciative of it. And it's like care versus quality care, you know what I mean? So, and that's a lot of times we receive just care, you know what I mean? So all of the stories that I was able to listen to with the other young women that were doing the stories and doing the videos, you know, we just sat there and was like, yeah, you know, we've all experienced some level of racism and trauma during our pregnancy. So I thought, you know, Rajani and the young women they just did an amazing, amazing, amazing job. So I thank you. I never got a chance to thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for like getting this whole thing started. I mean, this is an incredible team.
Destiny, maybe you could also share, how did you feel telling your story and meeting these other women who had similar experiences to you?
I also thought I was the only one. I was like, maybe it's because I had my son when I was 21 in Brooklyn. And I thought I was like, maybe it's just like, kind of we got to accept it and shove it off. It's like, kind of what the standard was. Like, I didn't hear any of my family members complain about it. It was kind of like, you kind of got to roll with it. So hearing all everybody else's story is like, oh, so this is an actual problem. Like, this is like, not just like, because I was young, and it was not because of the hospital I was in. It was not because, I don't know, some not because of these little tiny factors that I thought it was, not because of my income, or not, it's literally because I'm a Black mother. And it was like, this is an actual problem. Hearing all these mother stories, I'm like, yeah, this is not something that I'm comfortable with anymore. And it kind of turned me away. My story and other mother's story, like from, it almost discouraged me from having another child, almost. But it's like, you kind of started to question like why the medical system is kind of against you.
To find out more about the Birch Justice Storytelling Project, we will provide links along with the story on our website and social media platforms.
And for those of you just tuning in, I'm Andrea.
And I'm Kaylin. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine and on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And to learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out at online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour note bone to pick, email us at mediasanctuary.org. Next up, Hudson Mohawk Magazine's H. Bosch Jr. continues to highlight bright members of the community in his Triple E series. This is part one of two parts of Bosch's conversation with John Carter, a 5'18 shining star from Schenectady, New York.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another segment of the show, Triple E's Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship. This is part four of a four-part segment highlighting the 518 Shining Stars. Today's guest, / Shining Star, the 518's very own, born, bred, and buttered in Schenectady, New York, John Carter. John is currently serving as Global Director of Travel Industry and Business Travel Sales for Omni Hotels and Resort. Please go to my Facebook page, H. Bosch Jr., to see John Carter's complete bio. Hey, welcome, 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 John. How are you?
Great. Thank you for having me today.
Growing up, who were your role models and why?
For me, growing up, I always was drawn to sports and athletics. I think that, you know, that's common for a lot of men, but I love playing sports. So I looked up to a lot of basketball players. I think many people looked up to Michael Jordan. Maybe people looked up to Shaq. But as I got older, I've looked for people who have inspired me in different ways, people who have business ventures, people who have gone outside of what they originally thought they were destined for and looked to expand. So over the years, I've continued to evolve, but I think growing up, for me, the impact was sports initially, dedicated to their craft and work hard to get to their desired results.
So who inspires you now?
Now, I try to look across the board. I look for inspiration in different ways. You know, I love someone like Jay-Z, who has expanded beyond music and is
looking at
the community, has business ventures in many different areas. I look at someone like Barack Obama, even though I definitely do not want to be a politician. I really enjoy his message and what he means to the people, and what he's meant to me has been an inspiration. You know, continuing to look at people I know, my father, my mother has certainly been huge influences in my life and those who I come across. But, you know, I'm always looking for inspiration in new areas.
So what would you tell a young person struggling to succeed today?
That today is not necessarily where they're going to end up. You know, today is just a moment in time. And if you work hard and make the right decisions and place yourself in the right, you know, areas of opportunity, that you can advance beyond that. I tell my 14-year-old daughter that, you know, sometimes the coolest kids in high school have peaked at that point and maybe they don't continue to progress. You always want to wake up each day and make it your best. you know, whether, you know, a personal record, whatever that you're doing, you know, take each day as an opportunity to do better than the day before. Mistakes, you know, we have to learn through those mistakes. So don't be afraid that you're not going to make mistakes. We all fail. But don't let yesterday define who you're going to be tomorrow. Just keep pushing forward.
Mm-hmm. How old are your children, by the way?
I have a 14-year-old and a 1-year-old. So we got
Oh, goodness gracious. What got into
nice spectrum
you?
Here.
14-year gap, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, well, my 14-year-old is my stepdaughter, you know, okay. But she's been in my life since she was 3. So, you know, that's my girl, and we've raised her and you know, just keep moving forward. So we have quite the gap in our house, but great. You know, we're filled with love, and actually the 14-year-old has been a great assistance as we have a baby to help us out and to help mold her little sister. So I always make sure to remind her that she's an example. And, you know, regardless of what she wants, she has to be cognizant of those watching her present and to be a role model for her sister.
And it's so good to have a two-parent household from which you grew up in, you know.
Yeah.
I know, of course, you know, little girls and their moms' relationships are special, but it's also very special, little girl's relationship with her dad. So that's great. That is absolutely great to hear. So what was it like growing up in the 518, Schenectady?
It was cold, you know. Schenectady is cold. You know, I like upstate New York. It was an interesting place. You know, I was very fortunate. Like you said, I had two parents in my household. A lot of my friends didn't necessarily grow up like that. You know, sometimes I felt like I was held to a higher level of accountability, which was true and actually has ended up serving me quite well in life to hold myself higher than those of my peers and, you know, to keep my expectations and dreams living. So I was fortunate to have that within my home, but you know, outside of that, sometimes you could see that people were struggling. There was a lack of opportunities, specifically with people of color. You know, going to a private school, there wasn't many of us there. And, you know, I didn't necessarily like the way that felt all the time, that there was not always a connection between me and some of my peers that I would have liked. So as I've grown in life, I've definitely looked to seek that out. But, you know, I think it was great. I was raised close to my family. I was raised in an environment where I was able to flourish and grow and not be dragged down by some of the things around me. But you know that there are issues
in the 518
to get addressed. And, you know, I at times I feel very fortunate that I was able to leave. I know a lot of people who weren't. You know, I think that was almost instrumental to my success was to like leave and go to college just to get away from where I grew up. So I would have a different perspective on how I dealt with things when I was home.
What made you move from home besides dad saying 3 words? Help with my mortgage.
You know, for me, I went to Syracuse University, so that's only 2 hours west of Schenectady, and I was close. And, you know, I knew I didn't want to stay in Syracuse. I knew I didn't really want to come home and be in Schenectady, and I did for a few months after I graduated. But for me, I think it started in high school. My mom has friends in New York, and she brought me down for a Sweet 16 party, and I love New York. I knew I wanted to be there. You know, we had gone down and vacationed and different things in the city, and I just loved the energy. I thought it was so electric. It was so much different from where I grew up, and that's really the environment I wanted to be around.
Right.
So leaving Schenectady to go to college was the first step in experiencing something else. I picked up a lot of friends from New York City along the way. So after college, that seemed like the natural transition for me. And, you know, I like it because I'm still close to home. I can get to see my parents like 2.5 hours, which is great. But I think that just from a business perspective and career advancement, there's been some more opportunities here. Just the city's bigger. There's a lot more going on. And that's kind of what led me to leave.
Talk to me about your formal education, Syracuse. I mean, what made you go from cold to colder?
You know? Yeah, I mean, so I started Syracuse in 2004. This was like, you know, a year removed from the national championship. So Syracuse was always, you know, was on the mind. Carmelo Anthony,
right.
You know, a great sports team. Even though I knew I wasn't going to play basketball there, I definitely wanted to go be in that environment, a big university. It was probably, you know, my high school had a total of 400 students. So I wanted something big. I wanted a change. And that was really big, but still close to home. So that seemed like the right mix. I have family members that also went to Syracuse. So it's something I always kind of thought about in the back of my mind. So, you know, I went there originally to take a degree in mechanical engineering and quickly realized that was not my calling. And then I transitioned into the hospitality and food service management.
Okay, and I understand Dad is a cook, a master chef, right?
Yeah. Retired at this point, so he'll tell you he only cooks for those he loves. And fortunately, I'm still on the list, so I get to eat nice.
Good for you. Close out with this then, and then we'll go to part two. So Dad was a chef, and I noticed in one of your pictures you sent me, I guess you hung around the kitchen with him, right?
Yeah, he got me working, you know, which was great. You know, at 14, I was able to have part-time jobs and earn a little income and, you know, save a little bit, but start to see what it was like in the real world, which was powerful for me. I think I was one of, you know, out of my friends, I was one of the earliest to start working. And when you have your own money, it's nothing like having your own money. You know, I was fortunate where I had money and my parents weren't necessarily taking it back from me to help them pay for things as I might do with my kids now.
Try coming back home now and see how that works.
Right. Yeah. So it was great. You know, I got his experience. He always told me not to really strive for a career in hospitality, which is what I ended up doing. But it was good to get exposure into the working field and feeling more adult and, you know, to get that responsibility under my belt.
Okay. So then I would say, or would it be safe to say, you know, your way around the kitchen, you can burn a little bit.
I could cook a little bit. You know, my skill set has been more focused on front of the house, interacting with customers and clients, you know, from front office. So I never really had a culinary position. I did take some culinary classes in college and I can whip up a little bit around the house, but certainly nothing like my father. You know, I'm fortunate. My wife does cook sometimes. So we tag team in the kitchen.
Okay.
I can cook a little bit, right. Nothing.
How about that? So, yeah. John, we're going to take a little break and then we're going to come back with part two. Okay.
Okay.
Remember this: dance like there's no one watching, sing like there's no one listening, love like you've never been hurt, and you better live like it's heaven on earth. Until next time, folks, don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference. This is Inez Bosch's baby boy, H. Bosch Jr., your overcoming adversity specialist, doing what I'm made to believe.
That was H. Bosch Jr., who continues to highlight bright members of the community in his Triple E series. This is part one of two, Bosch's conversation with John Carter, a 518 shining star from Schenectady, New York. To hear the second part of this podcast, go to mediasanctuary.org.
And today we continue with part two of the interview Elizabeth Priss did with Kim Brown in Bedford Correctional Facility. In this part of the interview, they discuss Kim Brown's health, COVID-19 in prison, how the Me Too movement affects her, and more.
At Bedford, you're living there with the backdrop of this pandemic that we're experiencing all over the world, and your health yourself has suffered. Can you tell us about your health in general and then about COVID in Bedford?
Absolutely. My health. Oh, New Year's Eve of 2020, I was taken from Bedford to Northern Westchester Medical Center with something called kidney stones. And oh my stars, I think the kidney stones came as a result of a medication that I was taking for migraine, but never had the migraine rock my whole being the way those kidney stones did. Well, they put these things called JJ stents in me, and I had so many complications with that, and in the middle of it, COVID happened, and so I wasn't able to go out and get them removed. So they weren't removed until around June, and this is something that should have been removed in March. So I thought I was going to have, you know, irreparable damage because of them. Like, I thought I was going to have to wear an adult diaper because I became incontinent, completely incontinent. Fortunately, it was not irreparable. Once I did go out and get them removed, my body started to return to normal. Right now, I'm dealing with elevated platelets, which the doctor said is a mystery. He doesn't understand why. And the other things that normally would go along with elevated platelets, I don't have those symptoms. So he said, this is a mystery, and we're going to have to go through some tests and figure out what's going on. Now, I had a complete internal sonogram back in June, and everything was fine. So then when he got these lab results back, because I was nauseous, I had no appetite right before Thanksgiving. And the day after Thanksgiving, I went to medical, and they put me in immediate quarantine. They did a whole COVID protocol on me. I was in isolation, then I went to quarantine. I spent 19 days between isolation and quarantine. I had a temperature of 102.8, and they really didn't know what was going on. So now there is this looming, what now? You know? Like, you know, I used to be afraid, like, am I going to make it home to spend quality time with my mom? And now it's like, am I going to make it home? Because every time I turn around, there's something else going on with me.
Especially now with COVID-19, how many cases do you know about that have been active in Bedford, and what is it like being there?
When I was in isolation in the infirmary, there were probably 15 other people in isolation who were positive. I wasn't. My test came back negative twice. I kind of felt like, you guys are putting me in harm's way. As soon as I went to the clinic and they discovered that I have fever, they started this COVID protocol. But when the second test came back negative, I said, I want to be released against medical advice. And they told me no. Finally, on Monday, they did release me, but then they released me to quarantine, which is a housing unit that's completely empty. I was in an empty cell with nothing, no bed linen, nothing, just no shower shoes, nothing in the room. And you know, fortunately, they did allow us to get a commissary buy, so I had money in my account, but I ended up having to buy stuff that I already owned, you know, and that was frustrating. I spent over $100 on stuff that I already had, but it was in my cell.
And in general, what has changed? What are the precautions or protocols that Bedford takes for COVID now?
They have a housing unit, 12 C&D, that they have set aside just for quarantine. It's 60 cells. But I guess they use contact tracing. If someone tests positive, everyone that's been around them goes to quarantine. The person that tests positive goes to the medical building, to the infirmary.
And have programs been canceled or postponed?
Some programs are running. ASAT is a drug program that's running. Well, DMV, of course, is running. Ooh, the library is open now.
And then you mentioned earlier in life some of the abuse that you went through. I don't know if you were aware of something called Me Too, which was a big movement in terms of calling out people's abusers. I was wondering if you could talk about how that plays out in prison.
There are two things that give me pause when you talk about the Me Too movement. One is that I was sexually abused as a child. I was with a man who was 25 years old and I was 13. I was told to go with him by a family member who had a drug problem at the time. When I, as an adult, I thought I was in love with this man. And later he came and showed up here and I married him. So I married my pedophile and we're now divorced. For my whole life, I romanticized that relationship. But then when I discovered in therapy that no, that was not a relationship, you were the victim of sexual abuse. I tried to have him prosecuted. When this new law passed for children to be able to sue their abuser, I tried to contact someone to sue him or have him prosecuted. and no one would take the case. They're only interested in people who have a lot of money. Like, so I had to drop it. But here in Bedford, what's insane is that in the 70s, there was a lawsuit that granted curtains to block the doorway, because otherwise you're in there, you're in, if you use the toilet, if you change your clothes, you're completely exposed to anyone walking by. And now they've taken those curtains away and they've given handkerchief-sized curtains that only cover the window when the door is closed. Well, going to the bathroom is like playing red light, green light, 1, 2, 3, because if you're on the toilet, the door could open and you're right there. And male officers make rounds in the shower. The shower curtain, you're exposed because the top of the shower curtain is clear. And when I step up into the shower, I'm 5'9". When I step up into the shower, I'm head, shoulders, and breast above the partition. And so anyone that's in the shower while I'm in there can see me. In the middle of the Me Too movement, it's unconscionable. And the depth of Priya, who is supposed to be the person protecting us, is the one that's making these rules most of the time.
Why do you think that these rules from the 70s have been stripped away?
Honestly, because some people have abused the privilege. If the officer is making rounds, they can't see in the room because the curtain is up. It's count time and the curtain is up. Well, you know what? When I got here in 1995, if your curtain was up when the officer was doing the count, your door didn't open for the next 30 days, and there was nothing to talk about because you got a misbehavior report for interfering with the count, and you spent the next 30 days locked. And so the curtain being up during count was not a thing. But now, if the curtain is up, the officer stands there knocking and knocking and knocking and knocking and knocking. Then they make a fuss about it, and now they've taken all the curtains away. Are you kidding me? So it's a very strange thing. Like, the three-tier disciplinary process is supposed to be the mechanism by which they control these kinds of things. But they don't use it properly. What they use it for is to get back at people that they're pissed at.
Kim Brown, as we wrap up this two-part interview covering your health, clemency, COVID-19, Me Too. Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you want to make sure our audience hears about?
I wish I had time to think about that question because it's such an important question and I don't want to answer it haphazardly. This is a forgotten society. I think that's what I want people outside of here to know. There are mothers here who never get to see their children. There are grandmothers who never get to see their grandchildren. There are women here who are just forgotten about. Don't forget about your loved ones. Don't forget about your family. If you have someone in your life who is incarcerated, it doesn't matter what they did. It doesn't matter why they're here. It doesn't matter what your relationship was. They need you now. We are so alone here, and people who are alone do things out of desperation that they normally wouldn't do. So please remember your loved ones. If you only send them a card saying, I'm thinking about you, it's so important.
Kim Brown, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day and for sharing your story with us on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that was part two of Kim Brown's interview from Bedford Correctional Facility. If you missed part one on the clemency, you can listen to on our website at mediasanctuary.org.
And next up, David Banks works as a visiting assistant professor at the University of Albany. He also is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America and Troy DSA. David spoke with HMM correspondent Erica Diggs about why we should defund the police and how it can be beneficial and more.
So recently, 2020 has taken us for a spin when it came to police brutality and rights for Black and brown people. This is Asian Room correspondent Erica Diggs for the Media Sanctuary, and today I am speaking with David Banks. He is a visiting assistant professor on geography and planning at University of Albany, SUNY, member of Democratic Socialists of America, and he is going to tell us why it is important to defund the police, amongst other things. Please welcome my guest, David Banks. How are you doing today?
Good. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You know, let's just get right to it. So why should we defund the police and freeze the hiring process?
I'm going to give you some Troy numbers. I bet significantly less money than the money we're about to talk about, that it's the same case, a very similar situation in just about every city in the United States. All right. The Troy Police Department gets 28% of our budget. Right. So the $75.8 million budget that the mayor proposed for 2021, $41.6 million goes directly to the police department. That does not include 911 services. That does not include fire protection. That does not include traffic, parking fines and fees. None of that is included in that $41.6 million. And top it all off, that $41.6 million reflects a more than $700,000 increase from 2020. So we're throwing more and more money at the police department. And I would take Republicans in the city at their word that crime is going up, right? I think if it were any other government agency, right, we would look at it and say, okay, well, if the point of the police department is to reduce or prevent crime and crime is going up, what are they doing with a third of our money, right?
Right.
And so we have to start thinking more fundamentally, more critically about how we prevent crime, help communities heal after crime has been committed, and just generally, you know, make Troy a safer, better place to live. The first half, because, you know, there's only so much money in the city, right? The first half is taking some money away from the police. Part that gets me excited, actually, is then the where does it go? And it can go to lots of really important stuff.
Definitely, definitely. Okay, so, you know, I've recently seen something about demilitarizing the police. What would it entail for us to do that? And honestly, do you think that's such a completely good idea? And if so, why?
So this is another really good question, right? Because it's complicated because, you know, in the United States, we have a Second Amendment. People have a lot of guns. And you do have to think about, well, if the part of the government that is tasked with upholding laws, do they need to like outgun, you know, the citizenry, right? You know, like that's one thing to think about. There's no straightforward answer to that. The other part of it, though, is that, you know, this is kind of an arms race and someone has to make the first step. And I think it would be fair for police to do that in some respects, or at least we have to start changing the conversation around what policing looks like, right? And so, for example, one thing that we at Troy DSA really want to focus on is the 1033 program. And what that is it's a federal program that basically acts as like the Big Lots of military gear, right? So the federal government buys a bunch of, you know, MRAPs, Hummers, utility trucks, guns, vests, all the whole nine yards, right? And whatever the military doesn't use, they sell to police departments at severely reduced costs. And sometimes, you know, like some slightly used stuff also gets sent to the offered to police departments at deep discounts. And right now, Troy PD, we're not completely sure what they've procured through the 1033 program. It might not be much of anything, but they do see them walking around Troy in army fatigues.
Indeed.
With really big guns. And it, you know, sometimes I can't say that that's never warranted, but you know, it does say something about, you know, what you think about the people you're policing if you walk around like an occupying army.
Indeed. It seems as if they're scared of the community.
At best scared. At worst, you know, there is, I would say, that comes off as there are people that are to be protected, and then there are people that they are protecting those people from, right? Some people are the subjects of police violence, and some people are benefactors of police violence. That's a dynamic that I don't think can last.
I want to touch upon that because I recently did see trucks in Troy. Twice, actually, at that. I was somewhere around Lansingburg, and then recently I was right before Lansingburg, and I seen a truck. I was walking, and I seen big old army trucks, and I'm a military brat, so I know what they look like instantly. What is that? I was like, what are they doing here? And they're scaring the community.
Yeah, no, it is. These trucks and gear are meant to be scary, right? Because it's for war, right? And part of war is at least scaring or humiliating your enemy, right? And showing a big, you know, shock and awe force. And that's what these, you know, this material does. And it's, and if you want to talk about, you know, making the community heal or having a better relationship with the community that's policed, that I don't see these things as working together at all.
Why do you think the police department keeps getting away with such destructive behaviors?
I mean, frankly, it's because there's no consequences for that bad behavior, right? So I'll give you a really disturbing example, right? So way back in 2010, mm-hmm. Four officers were sued by a man named James Foley. Foley was assaulted by four police officers, Christopher Polly, Charles Castle, Joseph McNall, and George Anderson. They punctured his right lung. They fractured his left ankle, among several other injuries. Foley sued. And I believe we settled for an undisclosed amount of money, but it, you know, if it's anything like the ones that were disclosed, it's in the high five figures, right? Mm-hmm. $60,000 to $80,000, something like that, right? And that's your tax dollars, right? At least paying for the insurance plan that that cities usually take out, expecting this to happen, right? So part of this is like, you know, the whole system expects this to happen. This isn't it. There isn't something going wrong. This is business as usual. And what's business as usual in the Troy Police Department is that three of those four officers are not only still on the force, they've gotten raises, right? So Polly makes over $77,000 a year, and so does McNall. And Castle is making a little over $67,000. These are all public. This is as of 2019, so they could be making more. And this is all public record, right? That they make this much money, and that is their job, right? Is at least to be insulated from the consequences of puncturing someone's lung and fracturing their ankle. In 2013, the Times Union's Ken Crow wrote that Foley's attorneys had, quote, in their possession, scores of complaints of misconduct against Troy police officers that were ignored, not investigated, or whitewashed by superiors who are deliberately indifferent to the rights of citizens they are hired to protect. That was Foley's attorneys stating that way back in 2013. And nothing has changed.
Remember Patrick McMahon covering up that murder that happened, I want to say, a couple years ago? I believe it was 2016. What are your thoughts on that?
It's business as usual again. It pains me to say that, right, this is bipartisan, right? Republicans and Democrats do this. The cover-up of Edson Thevenin's murder by Randall French, I think it's a cover-up of a murder. I don't think it's much more complicated than that. There are reports stating that everything that the police department is saying happened did not happen, but the city of Troy does not want to see those released. As a Troy DSA, we have filed a FOIL request, a Freedom of Information Law request, to get these reports, specifically the Rinaldi memo that was supposed to reveal why Sergeant French's actions were justified. That report is still secret. And mm-hmm. even after, I think we've asked for them four times, in addition to all the officers' disciplinary records, we've asked for all of these four times. And each time the city's council has said that they're just not ready to hand those over. And with the case of the Rinaldi memo, actually, they have declined it, citing attorney privilege, that this is a work from an attorney and therefore is not subject to the FOIL request.
To me, that says, you know, they have a lot to cover up and a lot to hide. If you don't want to give out records, what's stopping you?
Yeah, they at least don't have a good answer to that accusation.
All right. So how would we as a community go about holding the Troy police accountable for misdeeds?
So we have a couple options, right? One big one is that we need to have a civilian review board that has some teeth to it, right? Has the ability to, for example, subpoena witnesses and officers to bring them in front of a board, compel them to tell the truth under pain of perjury, and get to the bottom of like some really serious, disturbing events that have never been sufficiently studied or investigated. So that needs to happen. And I think that includes something that, that isn't institutional, is more cultural, right? We need to start recognizing that the police department is just another part of city government, and that we should really consider it, frankly, something close to corruption, that our city council president is the aunt of the Police Benevolent Association president. Carmela Montello, mm-hmm. her nephew is Nicholas Laviano, the Troy Police Department's PBA president. That's, how can you ever expect her to hold them accountable?
Right.
If they're literally family.
It's a lot like that. Even where I'm from, because I'm not originally from the capital region, but where I'm from, you know, everyone in the police department is literally related. So mm-hmm. if something was to happen, I'm pretty sure things like that happen all the time in my city as well. I just don't hear about it.
Yeah. There's plenty of stuff that we just haven't heard about. And, you know, in Troy, there's you know, the case of Dominic Comitale, who, as far as I know, the only officer that has been so publicly disinterested in ethics or the rule of law that they finally allowed him to resign. They didn't fire him. They allowed him to resign. His family is known all over North Central as, you know, a particularly dangerous and disturbing family of police officers, is from what I heard. I'm not alleging that, but I've heard that.
Right. Okay. So, okay, folks. Well, this is part one of a two-part segment with Mr. David Banks. He is a visiting assistant professor of geography and planning at the University of Albany and a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. Thank you so much, David. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. And this has been HM correspondent Erica Dulcinea Diggs for the Media Sanctuary. And once again, I spoke with David Banks. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was part one of two segments. If you have any questions or concerns, email the Troy DSA at troydsacapitaldistrict.org. Follow them on all social media platforms as well.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Kaylin. Our engineers for tonight is the amazing Alexa Goldsmith and Sina Bazilal Hickey. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have any comments, suggestions, or to comment on our work, email us at hudson@hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
And as a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. by sending an email requesting an invitation link to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.